This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Nicholas Thompson.
Nick, you're the editor of NewYorker.com, and you write a lot about technology. You used to work at Wired magazine. Mm-hmm. So we think of you as the tech guy, but you also play guitar pretty seriously. And there you're totally low-tech. Talk about that.
That's funny. I hadn't thought about that contrast. Yeah, when I play guitar, I just play acoustic guitar, not electric, and I use my fingers. I don't use a pick. So it's the most organic way you can play guitar. And it's not intentional or it's not deliberate. It's just the way it happened. It turns out that's the form I can play well.
So who's in the category of people who are low-tech and that you idolize and as guitar players?
You know, it started out as a lot of people who play the kind of music I do with a guy named Leo Kottke. And then other players at the time, Michael Hedges, Seth Austin were important influences. I liked William Ackerman a lot. And then I discovered John Fahey along the way, and that was transformative.
So I don't want to reveal any secrets here, but you keep a guitar in your office, and you keep it sadly tuned to some crazy opening tuning, so open tuning, so I can't play it all that well. Did you just hate rock guitar and immediately went to this?
No, my first music experience was in a Guns N' Roses cover band, actually, in high school. I just wasn't good at it. And then I discovered fingerstyle guitar, and I was much better at playing that kind of music.
Explain what that is, fingerstyle guitar.
Right, it's not just not using a pick, it's you're not playing chords, you're not singing, you're just making instrumental music, often with open tunings. There's often a lot of harmonies in the background, there are often notes droning, and it has a fairly distinctive sound.
So you spent this summer poring over a biography of John Fahey.
The book is called Dance of Death, and I really enjoyed it. So after finishing it, I sent the author, Steve Lowenthal, a note, and I went up to his apartment where he has an incredible collection of Fahey records, all LPs, of course. And we sat down and listened to a few of them and talked about them.
John Fahey was one of the sort of original record collectors in a lot of ways. He would drive down to the Deep South, and you know, this was during the late 50s. He would literally go knocking on doors, asking people if they had any old records they wanted to get rid of.
This is when he's, what, 19 years old?
He's just a teenager. Yeah, absolutely. 17, 18. He did this all through his early 20s.
And he'd find some incredible stuff, right?
He found recordings that literally had been uncatalogued and no one had ever heard before.
Who was somebody he found? Skip James, right? He found Skip James in a hospital, right?
Indeed.
Let's put on Skip James.
Sure.
Let Jesus lead you. Let Jesus lead you. Let Jesus lead you. All the way. All the way.
He found Skip James, literally suffering from testicular cancer in a hospital. And John was so excited because Skip James had this deep, dark guitar tuning that John was just infatuated with, and he really wanted the secret to Skip James's guitar sound.
And Skip James had been sort of forgotten. He hadn't recorded in a long time.
And he wasn't a popular artist to begin with. I mean, his recordings were obscure at their time. But, Fahey sort of looked for the most obscure and the most esoteric of the blues musicians.
Why, at 18, 19 years old, is John Fahey from Tacoma Park, Maryland? Why does he do this? Is it the adventure? Is it the romanticism? Is
you have to understand, there wasn't any music that spoke to him in the way that this old blues music did. the popular music of his time was, Rosemary Clooney and sort of this, genteel sort of, suburban sort of 1950s pop music. And he was a really unhappy kid growing up. He was dealing with a lot of issues at home. And there wasn't any, rebellious music that spoke to sort of the darkness and ennui that, the blues to John offered him really a window into his own dysfunction.
Fahey comes back from the South and he starts to record his own music. Let's listen to a little bit of his first album. It's called The Legend of Blind Joe Death.
John wanted to make sort of, his take on a blues record, but he's not from the Deep South and he's never, he didn't have the blues in the classic sense. So he creates this fictional alias, Blind Joe Death, which is sort of his, goof on sort of the legends and the myths that all these writers make of these old blues guys. So his idea was like, I'm going to make the most extreme blues character I could think of. And Blind Joe Death was sort of his approach. The further he moved away from the blues and the more sort of, avant-garde and classical elements he would bring into the picture, the music sort of got a little stranger, got elongated.
So tell me one of your favorite strange tracks from this period.
Oh, sure. This track I'm going to play is from John Fahey, Volume 4. It's called Sail Away, Ladies.
So when did drinking become a serious problem for Fahey?
Right around when he started performing. He had terrible stage fright and he hated getting in front of audiences. But I think John was insecure about his abilities as a guitar player, next to some of the more flashy, technically precise people in the folk scene. So he would just get obliteratedly drunk in order to deal with it. Once he started doing that, he started getting obliteratedly drunk to deal with all of his problems. So he decides to get his master's in folk music, which was a new program at UCLA. He moved to West Coast really for his academic studies, and the folk scene there was really in full swing. And he didn't really have any use for
right.
the 60s folk scene. What he was trying to do is sort of this hybridized, modern, classical, contemporary, like death chants, which is sort of like the exact opposite of this peace, love, sort of pre-hippie movement. To him, there's a bunch of rich college kids sitting around talking about civil rights who had never gone through any hardships themselves. So he felt that it was inauthentic and it was BS. I mean, he wasn't interested in it.
At some point here in the mid to late 60s, he decides he's actually going to make some money doing a Christmas record. Tell me about this.
He did. I mean, that was his thing. He was in a record store and during Christmas season, and he saw this guy opening up a box of Bing Crosby White Christmas records, and he asked the guy about it. And the guy's like, yeah, we sell a box of these every year. And he said, that's a great idea. And so he made a Christmas record, and there was actually a market for acoustic instrumental versions of Christmas songs, and it became his best-selling record.
I've got to admit, I've listened to a lot of John Fahey in my life. I have never listened to his Christmas music. So let's hear something.
Sure.
Thank you. pretty good. All right, maybe I'll listen to this record in full when I get home. All right, so during this period, 1967 and 1969, he's recording an album every 15 minutes.
Yeah.
He also starts a label, Tacoma, and he finds a young musician named Leo Kaki. Let's put on Leo Kaki's record, 6 and 12 string guitar. I just love this record so much. Listen to it 1,000 times.
Leo Kaki was, in a lot of ways, everything John Fahey wasn't. He was young, personable, an amazing technical guitar player, lightning fast. And in some ways, it's to John's credit that he could recognize, you know, sort of the potential of someone like Leo Kaki.
I mean, this is an album that every guitarist has listened to. So how important was Fahey to the recording of this album, 6 and 12 string guitar?
Hugely important. Leo sent in his demos and asked, you know, what he should do and if he should sing and whatnot. And John said, no, just do, you know, acoustic guitar. Just do an instrumental record. John heard the potential of what Leo had. And, you know, Leo Kaki delivered a tour de force guitar record that changed the nature of acoustic guitar music. Leo's from the Midwest. He's a young guy. And John invites him to stay with him in California. And he goes to John's place, and John puts him on the couch and says, listen, whatever you do, don't wake me up. So, you know, a couple hours later, Leo's just sitting there, just watching TV, you know, minding his own business or something. And John Fahey slams the door open, puts a shotgun in his face, and screams at him, I told you not to wake me up. How dare you wake me up? And Leo was terrified, and perhaps lacking a certain amount of common sense, he did not flee. But he stuck around, and he said afterwards, Leo said if he survived that first night, then he figured nothing worse would probably happen to him.
So after this, after Kotke, Fahey's music evolves a little bit more, and he puts forward, I think, my favorite album is Fair Forward Voyagers. I know I'm in a minority opinion on that among John Fahey fans.
There's a lot of people that think so.
And he puts out America, which I think a lot of people think is his best. Why don't we listen to America?
Sure. Both America and Fair Forward Voyagers are that find John at the height of his powers as a guitar player and as a composer. I think it's the furthest away from the blues, and it's the most unique in his catalog in terms of just straight guitar playing, and it's the most Fahey-esque. He's a pretty bitter, unhappy guy. You know, he hates the whole New Age thing. He hates playing with all those people. And yet that's his livelihood, and he absolutely resents it. He moves out of L.A. in the 80s. He moves up to Oregon. He's kind of out of the music scene and gets increasingly angry and hostile and difficult. And he sort of devolved so much that he didn't really want to be part of society anymore. And he sort of moved into a cheap, you know, weekly motel and just, you know, covered himself in pizza boxes and garbage and, you know, lived basically like a crazy person.
All right, so he's living in pizza boxes, in cheap motels, in shelters, and he kind of gets rediscovered in 1994. Tell me that story.
There's this guy, Byron Coley, who's a music writer. You know, he's had this idea to write this story about John Fahey, so he pitched it to Spin Magazine. You know, they flew him out to Oregon to do an interview with John Fahey, and Byron, you know, tracked him down at some motel and knocks on the door, and John opens up the door in total squalor with his robe hanging open, naked underneath, asking who he was, and Byron told him who he was, and John said, come back some other time. And Byron comes back the next day, And he goes, you know, what do you want to do? And Byron's like, oh, yesterday I just went around to record stores. And John and goes, oh, you didn't tell me you're going to record stores. That sounds great. Let's go. And so Byron's like, all right, let's go to every record store in Oregon.
So this article in Spin comes out. And then Fahey's life changes. For the last few years of his life, he's actually, he's kind of back on the scene.
It's a really interesting time, the mid-90s. So, like, it's 1994, Kurt Cobain's accepting an MTV Music Award wearing a Daniel Johnston t-shirt. Daniel Johnston was a schizophrenic who made home-recorded cassette tapes of his songs. Daniel Johnston got a deal on Atlantic Records. So all of a sudden, being a mentally unstable, you know, underground icon, for the only time I can recall in American history, was a viable commercial commodity. So John Fahey, all of a sudden, is the right guy at the right time. And of course, he rejects it and wants nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And decides to make avant-garde industrial sound collage music. Fell in love with this woman named Hitomi at a late 90s tour of Japan. Just a woman he met once, and he just became so deeply infatuated with her, he couldn't think of anything else. It got to the point, it got so bad that he tried to go see her in Japan, and he was greeted at the airport by the police. He was pretty despondent. He was an unhealthy guy with extreme excesses, and you know, sadly, John Fahey died at the age of 61 due to complications of a sextuple bypass operation.
Tell me what drew you to the story. Why did you decide to invest several years writing his biography?
It's weird. I'm not a superstitious guy. I'm a very practical sort of man. But in the liner notes to 1965's Transfiguration of Blind Joe Death album, John Fahey writes the story of a student who's writing his master's dissertation on a 20th century genius, John Fahey, set in the year 2010. Prior to reading it, I decided to get my master's degree and write my thesis on John Fahey. So John predicted my writing this book many years before I was born. This last song is called Dry Bones in the Valley. And I just think it's a great example of the level of feeling and ennui and sadness and darkness I feel is unparalleled in American music.
John Fahey on acoustic guitar. That was his biographer Steve Lowenthal in conversation with The New Yorker's Nick Thompson.